I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages.
Molly Hemingway speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window.
And this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left.
You can watch and listen to a recording of journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from our 2020 Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Even the casual student of recent history can probably tell you, in at least a rough form, what totalitarianism is, or what it looks like. Of course, a great example being the former Soviet Union. Totalitarianism can be overcome, but what about a new soft form of totalitarianism that doesn't necessarily come from government? It may come from, say, big business or your employer. Are we living in a pre-totalitarian society, and is the church ready for it? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism, Rod Dreher. He's senior editor at the American Conservative and author of the new book, Live Not by Lies, A Manual for Christian Dissidents. Rod, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be here.
On the heels of the first presidential debate, do either candidates for president appear to have soft totalitarianism, our subject for today, on their radar screens?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I saw the first debate. It was incredibly depressing. And I say that as a conservative. I've never been a Never Trump conservative, but just to see the way the president conducted himself last night was really sad and appalling and worrisome for me, because the Democrats, they are avatars of soft totalitarianism. They're, as they continue to advance in power, I mean, what they consider to be social justice is, for the rest of us, going to be a form of soft totalitarianism. We conservatives need to have skilled fighters to stop this. Watching President Trump last night, I thought, you know, I can really see how this is going to happen, because he's like a barroom drunk flailing around with his fists and not landing them accurately. And I really do fear that people are going to be so turned off by the way he behaved that they're going to vote for Biden. And look, when the Democrats get into power, the same sort of wokeness that is moving through American institutions and through big business is going to be solidified in the executive branch. So inadvertently, President Trump, by his behavior, is making it easier for the left to institute soft totalitarianism. That's not very cheerful, but that's how I feel.
This is the term of art, soft totalitarianism. How is that different from the totalitarianism that we saw probably most notably in the Soviet Union?
In the Soviet Union, that was what we would call hard totalitarianism. It involved exercising control, the state's control over every aspect of life, by threatening people with pain and terror, including imprisonment, torture, and even death. This soft totalitarianism that I foresee coming for us, it's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be less Orwell's 1984 and more like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. The people who will control our society will be those who force us to comply, not by inflicting pain and terror, but rather by manipulating our comforts and our status and our access to ordinary middle-class life in order to get us to conform. And this is one reason, to be honest, that so many Americans are blind to what's happening, because our idea of totalitarianism does involve the secret police and gulags. But meanwhile, it's creeping up more and more in ordinary institutions of middle-class life, where you can't dissent or you are going to be a pariah and sent to the margins of your society, much like dissidents were in the Soviet bloc.
What is the difference between totalitarianism and authoritarianism?
Great question. This is a distinction that's really important for political scientists, but often gets ignored in popular culture. Authoritarianism is when you have a society in which all political authority resides in one party or one leader. But not all aspects of life are politicized in an authoritarian system. I mean, all they care about is maintaining political power. Totalitarianism, on the other hand, is an extreme form of authoritarianism. All the power is held by a particular leader or a political party, but all aspects of life are politicized. In the Soviet Union, for example, after the Bolshevik Revolution, the Soviet chess society tried to keep politics out of chess competition. But one of the commissars in the Bolshevik state wrote and said, oh, there's no such thing as chess for chess's sake. Everything must be related to the revolution. Well, we're seeing this happen in our country in a much more subtle way with the so-called social justice warriors and their ideology. They're making everything, even this right now, college football, into an occasion to fill it with cultural politics. This is what I mean by totalitarianism. There is no way you can escape wokeness. They're going to infuse every aspect of life with it.
Why does soft totalitarianism require the eradication of Christianity?
There was this evangelical ethicist, David Gushee, who came out back in 2016 when he flipped over and decided that he was going to be in favor of LGBT rights. He wrote a column in which he said that evangelical Christianity is the only remaining obstacle to full LGBT rights. And I think he's right about that. The soft totalitarians, and we call them the woke, they believe that any institution, any way of life, any belief that stands in the way of full social justice, which for them means to realize your identity and live it out fully, that it must be smashed. It can't be tolerated. It has to be ended. Christianity is the only thing, in terms of the sexual revolution, Christianity, small O Orthodox Christianity, is the only thing standing in the way of them. So naturally, if they're going to create a socially just society, according to their definition, then we Christians are a problem, and we have to be not tolerated, but eliminated.
Tell us about Tomislav Pogljan.
Tomislav Pogljan was a Croatian Catholic priest who was doing anti-Nazi resistance work in Croatia during the Second World War. He got a tip that the Gestapo was coming after him, so he escaped under cover of darkness and went to Slovakia, where his mother was from, and adopted her last name, Kolakovic. So the new Father Kolakovic taught in the Catholic University in the capital of Slovakia, and he told his students, the good news is the Nazis are going to lose this war. The bad news is this country is going to be ruled by a Soviet puppet regime when it's over with. And the first thing they're going to do is come after the church. And we have to get ready for it. So what this Father Kolakovic did was organize small cells, small groups of really committed Christians who would come together for prayer, for study, and including the study of the arts of resistance, like how to survive an interrogation. He spread these cells of believers all around the country in small villages, things like that. The Catholic bishops of the time were really worried about this. They thought he was being alarmist and that he was worrying people too much. But Father Kolakovic had studied communism to be a missionary to the Soviet Union, and he knew the communist mind. Sure enough, when the Iron Curtain fell over Czechoslovakia, everything happened exactly as he said. The communists came right after pastors, priests, and bishops. And the little cells that Father Kolakovic organized, they became the backbone of the underground church in Slovakia. And sure enough, most of their leaders were thrown into prison. But when they came out of prison, they began to evangelize. And the underground church that Father Kolakovic organized, they were the prime resistance to communism for 40 years. He is an incredibly important figure. I didn't even know about him at all, that he existed, prior to doing research on this book. And I really do think that we are in a 1943 moment in this country when, like Father Kolakovic, we need to take advantage of the liberty we have now to wake ourselves up to what's coming and to start forming these small groups of prayer and resistance and network around the country.
Do you see any of that going on, Rod?
I don't see it happening right now. I think that a lot of Christians, Todd, understand that something is deeply, deeply wrong in this country, and it doesn't feel like normal times. Well, their perceptions are right, but so far, I don't see any kind of organized attempt to do something about it. Although, just this week, I got an email from one of my readers of my blog at The American Conservative, who said, look, I'm a Christian. I work in Silicon Valley. I know that you're correct about this, that a lot of this surveillance that they're going to do and the control is going to come from Silicon Valley, and it's going to be very hard for us to resist. This man said, I want to connect with other Christians in the tech world to start figuring out right now how we Christians will be able to exist online and communicate with each other in a time of soft totalitarianism. So look, that's a seed right there. It's just one seed, but this is a kind of initiative that Christians are going to have to take. Christians in ordinary walks of life, we can't just sit around and wait for the leadership of the institutional churches to provide it for us. If they do, great. But right now is an emergency time when ordinary Christians need to be creative and hooking up with each other to talk this out and lay the groundwork for a resistance.
We're talking about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. Rod Dreher is our guest. He's senior editor at The American Conservative and author of the new book, Live Not by Lies, a Manual for Christian Dissidents. When we come back, what is therapeutic culture and how is it related to soft totalitarianism?
And I went down to the demonstration to get my fair share of abuse, singing words gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50-amp fuse. Sing it to me. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want.
The church's music from the second century. The 6th century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Job saw the city as a wasteland, as if devoid of God, witnessing injustice to the poor by the corrupt, lawlessness of criminals, trafficking of children, blatant immorality, thinking God could not see wicked deeds done in the dark of night. Yet God never abandoned Job, nor his city, groaning for mercy. God is working through the living Redeemer, hands etched with salvation, pointing to the resurrection to come. Join us at lcms.org/citymission to seek peace and shine the light in the city.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. guest, Dr. Ben Mays of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here's what Martin Luther says about the pastoral office. My pastor is practicing the virtue that increases God's kingdom, fills heaven with saints, plunders hell, robs the devil, wards off death, represses sin, preserves peace and unity, and plants all kinds of virtue in the people. In a word, he is making a new world. He builds not a poor temporary house, but an eternal and beautiful paradise in which God himself is glad to dwell. We are calling good men to step up. Come to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Learn more about studying for the vocation of pastor at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, September the 30th, we're talking about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. Rod Dreher is our guest, author of the new book, Live Not by Lies, a Manual for Christian Dissidents. Rod, what is therapeutic culture and how is it related to soft totalitarianism?
One of my favorite intellectuals, or one of the most important intellectuals, is a man named Philip Reif. He died about 15 years ago. He was a secular Jew who was a sociologist and a biographer of Sigmund Freud. In 1966, he published an incredible book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. And again, this man was a secular Jew, not a believer of any kind, but he said that in Western society, we had ceased to look to any kind of outside code of virtue, whether from religion or some other code of virtue, as a guide to conduct. And instead, we had flipped over to a therapeutic society, meaning that we saw right and wrong as defined by what made us feel good, what made us feel less anxious. Reif said in 1966 that the churches were already conquered by this and didn't even realize it. He said it was a more revolutionary revolution than even the Bolshevik Revolution, because the communists at least believed in some objective idea of right and wrong. In the therapeutic society, there is no right or wrong. There is only how you feel. Well, I think that our society has become ever more therapeutic since Reif wrote that 50 years ago. And this has come to us not through any sort of government intervention primarily, but mostly through popular culture and entertainment culture and moral relativism. And the churches have not really stood up to this in any effective way. I think it's going to be having a meaning for soft totalitarianism, Todd, and that this totalitarianism that's coming will be, as I said earlier, a totalitarianism that manipulates people's feelings. If you look in Huxley's Brave New World, which is a much more accurate guide to what we're going to deal with than 1984, that's exactly how the world controllers work. There's this scene in Chapter 17 of Brave New World in which the savage, he's the resistor, he lives outside society, he has a confrontation with this character named Mustafa Mond, who is a world controller. And unlike in 1984, there's no torture involved here at all. Mond brings him in and says, look, I don't know why you want to be on the outside of this society. We offer you everything you could possibly want. There's sex, there's comfort, there's drugs, there's entertainment. What's not to like? He says, it's Christianity without tears. Well, Todd, that's the temptation that we're going to face in this society. We are going to face a temptation to conform, to keep all our middle class comforts and status intact. All we have to do is give up our political rights and our religious liberties. There are a lot of people, even people who profess Christ today, who are going to find a way to reconcile themselves to this demonic bargain. One way they're going to do it is by not perceiving that it is what it really is. You know, I'm being kind of long-winded here, but I've got to mention something I bring up in the book. There's this great movie that came out earlier this year called A Hidden Life. It's based on the true story of Franz Jägerstätter. He was an Austrian Catholic farmer, lived in an Alpine village, who, when the Nazis came to town, because he was a Christian and a spiritually disciplined Christian, he resisted them. He could see the Antichrist of Hitler for who he was, and he wouldn't go along with it. All the other people in the village, all of them churchgoers, they went along with the Nazis, but not Jägerstätter. He and his family were willing to withstand the hatred of all their neighbors, and he eventually went to prison, Jägerstätter did, and was executed by the Nazis because he wouldn't swear allegiance to Hitler. what Jägerstätter's life shows is that if you are going to be a true follower of Christ, you got to be willing to suffer even to the point of death to bear witness to our Lord. So many of these people in his village, they weren't willing to do this, and they succumbed.
What do you mean when you say that we are living in a pre-totalitarian society?
I read this book, this famous book called The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. She's one of the great political theorists of the 20th century. After the end of the Second World War, Arendt, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany, went back to look at how the Nazis came to power and also how the Bolsheviks came to power in the Soviet Union. What she wanted to know was what conditions made it possible for ordinary people to turn their eyes towards the Nazi Party or the Bolshevik Party and to see hope and a future in those totalitarian movements. And she came up with a list of characteristics in a pre-totalitarian society that she said had to exist before people as crazy as the Nazis or the Bolsheviks could take over. She said that the most important aspect of a pre-totalitarian society is mass loneliness, of radical loneliness, when people feel that they are disconnected from their neighbors and from any institution around them, their church, civic organizations, things like that. They become susceptible to the appeals of totalitarians. Well, we are there, Todd. If you look at the social science of loneliness, we have been becoming lonelier and lonelier and lonelier for the past few decades, and it is off the charts now. Another characteristic of pre-totalitarian society is a loss of faith in hierarchies and institutions. We see that everywhere now in our society. Another aspect, said Arendt, was the desire to transgress and to destroy. She said that in pre-revolutionary Russia and in the Weimar Republic in Germany, you had elites who were willing to destroy the foundations of civilization just for the fun of it, for the fun of seeing people who had been excluded come into power. I think of that now when I see statues of our founders being toppled, when I see on college campuses professors being driven out, speakers being no platform where they can't come speak. We're seeing professors who support these social revolutionaries going along with it, destroying the ability of a university to be what a university is supposed to be. All of these things, Todd, and there are more that Hannah Arendt brought up, and I write about them in the book, but these are signs that a society is ready to accept totalitarianism. We have so many of these alarms sounding at maximum volume right now in our society. I don't know exactly who this totalitarian leader is going to be, but more and more people are ready to accept it.
How does the death of classical liberalism, and you'll need to explain what that is, how does that relate to the rise of soft totalitarianism?
That's a great question. Classical liberalism is the philosophy on which our country was built. It emerged out of the Enlightenment. Our constitutional order is classically liberal. And what makes it liberal is it believes in freedom of speech, freedom of religion. It believes in individual rights, especially before the law, and it believes in free markets. Well, soft totalitarianism despises all these things. It sees freedom of speech and freedom of religion, for example, as threats to social justice. If our devotion to liberalism, again, classical liberalism, not just the philosophy of the Democratic Party, but the philosophy of people on the left and the right who believe in things like the First Amendment, if that is under threat, then we're in real trouble. And in fact, it is under threat. We see poll after poll done of the millennial generation and Generation Z finds that so many of them don't believe that freedom of religion is important. In fact, Generation Z, I believe it is going to be the first generation in American history in which a majority of them don't have any religious affiliation. Many of them believe that the First Amendment is not important at all, that free speech is something that should not be tolerated if it hurts the feelings of protected minorities, and on and on and on. So liberals, classical liberals, even people on the left, they are being targeted by these social justice warriors as well. There is a guy, Mark Lilla, who is a political scientist at Columbia University. After Trump won in 2016, he wrote a column in the New York Times saying, look, my fellow liberals, we have to wake up and understand that we did this to ourselves by embracing illiberalism and not paying attention to how the system crushes so many ordinary people. Because he did that, Mark Lilla was denounced by his own colleagues at Columbia as being a white supremacist, which is berserk. But this is how they work. This is how the soft totalitarians work. Anybody who defends old-fashioned liberal values, they're just as much an enemy as a Nazi in the eyes of these soft totalitarians. To the extent that we no longer teach civics in this country, we no longer teach the value of free speech and freedom of religion and so forth, we are paving the way for soft totalitarian dictatorship.
You spoke a moment ago about the aspects of a pre-totalitarian society. What are some of the signs of a coming soft totalitarianism? What should we be looking for?
Just before we got on the phone to do this interview, I received a letter from a lawyer in Missouri who sent me the details of a training that he had to do, he and other lawyers had to do, about quote-unquote implicit bias, right? And the details he sent me show that this is really a totalitarian way of thinking. He said that the teacher giving this instruction said, all of us here are racist. And that's just, I'm not even going to try to convince you of that. It's just true. And on and on and on. It's a small thing, maybe. But if this sort of thing is becoming a basis for the way law is taught and practiced in America, then that's a sign of soft totalitarianism, where it doesn't matter anymore who you are individually before the law. All that matters is your race. We're seeing this happen over and over again around the country in different institutions, in the media, in corporations, when they're doing all this critical race theory training, again, which is teaching people not to see each other as individuals with human dignity, but only according to their race or their gender or their sexual preference. We're seeing this in transgenderism laws, when in California, for example, you cannot opt your children out of gender ideology discussions in public school kindergarten. It is mandated by law that your kids have to accept that. All of these things are small, but when you put them all together, you begin to see that we are creating a society in which it is impossible to think outside of the lines that the social justice warriors draw. And if you do think outside those lines, you're going to become a pariah. You're not going to be able to go forward in your line of work, in your profession, and you may suffer more and more social penalties. I can't tell you, Todd, the number of emails I get every week from, usually from academics, but sometimes from people who work in business, saying that I'm walking on eggshells all the time, and it's becoming worse and worse around here. We can't say anything without fearing the loss of our jobs. I should say also, another big sign of soft totalitarianism is the fact that these big companies who are so dominant in our society are collecting massive amounts of data, personal data, on all of us all the time, just because of the way we use our smartphones and the way we search the internet. This is not a secret. This is not some tinfoil hat conspiracy theory. It's open. This is how they do business. In my book, I talk about how there's no law against collecting all this data, but what matters is how businesses use it. And in China, they have a social credit system. And this is something your listeners might not have heard of, but it's really, really important, because this is how I think that the soft totalitarianism is going to work in our country when it comes. In China, every single individual has a social credit rating given by the government, and it's a sign of trustworthiness. If you do things the government considers to be socially worthy, like downloading the speeches of Xi Jinping or going to a party meeting, then you get a higher rating. If you do things the government considers socially bad, like going to church or hanging out with people who are dissidents, you get a lower rating. And all this information is kept in computers and administered by artificial intelligence. If you have a lower social credit score, you find that you can't get the good jobs. Your kids can't go to college. You can't go to certain restaurants. You might not even be able to travel. The government never has to send a secret policeman to your front door, but they can get your compliance by limiting your freedom to live a normal middle-class life. Well, in our country, We already have the data collection that makes such a thing possible. All we lack is the political will to implement it. I really believe this is going to come. And a lot of people, Todd, who think it's only going to come through the government are mistaking the incredible power of big business, which has become totally progressive.
We're talking with Rod Dreher, senior editor at the American Conservative and author of the new book, Live Not by Lies, a manual for Christian dissidents about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. When we come back, do you think that most pastors and priests are aware of the assaults that their lay people are suffering against Christian truths in the workplace? We'll be right back.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
During a global pandemic, how can we find comfort in the hymn, From God Can Nothing Move Me? You'll find the answer in Pastor Will Whedon's column on Lutheran Dirges and Such in the latest Issues, Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, rapper Flame details his journey from Bapticostal and Reformed Baptist Calvinism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal. We are discussing a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. Rod Dreher, author of the book Live Not by Lies, a manual for Christian dissidents, is our guest. Rob, before the break, you were talking about the way that soft totalitarianism affects people in the workplace. Do you think that most pastors and priests are aware of these assaults on Christian truths in the workplace of their laity?
I wish I knew. Because under COVID, you know, we can't really get out and see people and talk like we used to. But I'm just not seeing right now any sort of real pushback from pastors and priests on this. Maybe they're not hearing about it from the laity, but I tell you, so many sermons for so long have been moralistic. Yeah, we need to be morally instructed, but so many pastors and priests are missing out on the deep threat that is coming, and it's coming as an angel of light, as in the terms of social justice. I really think that this is one of the gifts that the witness of these Christians from the former Soviet bloc have to share with us, because they see through the veil. They know what's coming. They know how these people make it sound so good, and who wouldn't want social justice, but they know that this is just a code word for something really, really dark. But I have to tell you, even they are being bamboozled by a lot of this. This one Slovak priest said, you know, it's harder now than it was in the communist days. In the communist days, the light of the gospel shone through that darkness and lit up a clear path through it. Now, the light of the gospel shines through it, and we're just hitting fog because, you know, it's so easy under hard totalitarianism because the line between right and wrong was very clear. Not so much under soft totalitarianism.
Why should we begin thinking of progressivism as a religion?
Progressivism is something that so many of us take in with our mother's milk. You know, we We think in this country, when we use the term progressive, we're talking about people on the far left of the Democratic Party. But in fact, the idea of historical progress as being natural to human life is something that we've all been raised with. It's the sense that things are going to get better and better all the time, and that anything new is good, anything old is bad. Well, that has now been weaponized by the political left. And the people who tend to identify as progressives, as those who are bringing forth a brave new world of social justice, they believe with all their hearts, like it's a religious axiom or something, like it's a dogma that everything old is bad and everything new is good. For me, Todd, I didn't really grasp this fully until I started researching the early Bolsheviks, you know, and how it was that they became active in Russia, and when they first caught on there, their movement caught on with the Russian people, I began to see that they really were a secular religion. They were very, very zealous. They believed in absolute right and wrong, and they believed that the evil people ought to be destroyed, and that they were fighting for goodness, and that there was no price too high to be paid to bring righteousness to power. Well, the price was paid in the blood of millions of martyrs of the Bolsheviks. But if you think of them as just a normal political movement, you're going to miss their essentially religious motivation. And I think the same is true with social justice warriors in this country. You know, they really believe what they believe with the passion of a zealot, and they can't be reasoned with at all. I think one of the most important moments in our country, in our country's recent history, came in 2015, the autumn of 2015, when Professor Nicholas Christakis of Yale University, he went out on the quad at Yale to try to reason with a group of students who were all social justice warriors. And you can see this on YouTube, by the way. I recommend your listeners go find this up. Nicholas Christakis at Yale. He was trying to use Socratic reasoning with them to dialogue with them about what they had in common and where they differed. They wouldn't have it. They just shrieked at him and yelled at him and called him names and cursed him because they believe they are right and he is wrong and error has no rights. This is what progressivism means to them. It means liberating the individual to be who he or she is more and more and shaking off all the things that keep us from liberation, keep us from progress, including religion and including now classical liberalism.
So you've raised the subject of social justice several times, and it's tied into basically kind of an emoting culture. What role does it play in progressivism as a religion, and is it essentially a different form of anti-intellectualism?
Well, social justice started out, the term started out as a Christian concept. A Jesuit priest, I think it was in the 19th century, said that Christians need to work for social justice. And all he meant by that was we Christians are supposed to work to bring about a more just society here on earth. It's our faith is not just about where we're going in the afterlife, but about building the kingdom of God here on earth. And I believe that. You know, all of us believe that that to be a Christian means you have to work for the good of your community. And in serving your community, you're serving God. In fighting injustice, you're serving the Lord. But a Christian idea of justice involves creating a society in which people are more free to live lives of Christian virtue, to be who God created us to be. There is no such thing as a sense of social justice that violates God's law. So, for example, a society in which abortion was permitted or gay marriage was permitted, that is an unjust society. You know, now we may have to tolerate some of this because eradicating those evils may be more costly than tolerating them. I don't want to get into the details here, but essentially we judge what is just by what the Bible tells us is God's law. In social justice, though, there is no sense of mercy and grace, any of that, in secular social justice. It is all about manipulation of power. They conceive of all human relations as always and everywhere issues of power and of who has the power, who doesn't have the power. And they believe that justice is giving the people who are more deserving all the power. So you have a situation in which this Ibram X. Kendi, he's become like the number one public intellectual because he advocates something he calls anti-racism. Well, he has this really crude and foolish idea of social justice in which if in a social situation there is a disproportionate number of people of color there, if they don't have enough positions in that within that institution, then it is a racist institution and we must smash everything that keeps an equitable number of people rising to positions of power. This is really, really crude. It's illiberal. It's emotional. But this is the sort of thing that more and more you are seeing major corporations, universities and other institutions, even churches, take up because nobody wants to be a racist. Racism is evil. I think we all agree that racism is evil. But what these social justice warriors, how they describe racism is pure cultural Marxism. And so many Christians are falling for it.
Rod Dreher is our guest. He's senior editor at the American Conservative and author of the new book, Live Not by Lies. We're talking about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. When we come back, he has coined the term woke capitalism. What is that? Because we don't usually put those two things together, but it exists and it affects you directly. We'll talk about it next. It's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Cleaning Authority has a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. You can save $25 on a one-time clean or $25 off your first two cleans. Learn more at our Facebook page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Now, if you live in Greater St. Louis, call 314-690-9877, 314-690-9877. Be sure to mention Issues Etc. The offer expires on September 30th. facebook.com/issuesetc.
I was born in a welfare state, ruled by bureaucracy, controlled by civil servants and people dressed in grey. Got no privacy, got no liberty, 'cause the 20th century people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a Christian response to soft totalitarianism. Rod Dreher is our guest, senior editor at the American Conservative. Rod, what is woke capitalism?
Yeah, that is something that is so important, and it is something that so many Christians just have no idea exists. Back in 2015, your listeners might remember in the state of Indiana, the state legislature passed a federal version of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. All it would have done would be to give people a religious basis for fighting anti-discrimination suits, just to say that, you know, I was practicing my religion. This was uncontroversial when it passed at the federal level in 1993. Well, the state of Indiana tried to do it in 2015. Suddenly, they got massive pushback from major corporations like Apple Computers, Salesforce, groups like the NCAA. All of them said, this is nothing but bigotry, and we're going to boycott your state and make you pay an economic penalty if you leave this law in place. Well, they backed down. A week later, the state of Arkansas, which was going to have pass a similar law, Walmart cleared its throat. It backed down. What this meant, this was a real turning point in the culture war, because prior to that, major corporations had stayed out of it. They didn't want to get involved. This time, corporations came and brought their political power, their economic power, to bear on cultural politics, and it worked. I hear from friends of mine who work for religious liberty at the state level, but this is happening everywhere, even in red states, where corporations who have business in that state come to the state legislatures and tell them, we're going to pull out if you pass any religious freedom legislation. In this way, the capture of major corporations by the forces of social justice and progressivism It's huge. I think so many of us think that totalitarianism is something that can only come from the government. But when you have corporations in our capitalist society deciding that they are going to put the thumb on the scale for social justice, it really, really matters. I'll tell you one story. I don't think this is in my book, but I heard it when I was over there in Eastern Europe interviewing for it. In Poland, I talked to Catholics who worked for the Polish branch of different European and American multinational corporations. They said that in their workplace, they were being compelled to support gay pride, even though it violated their conscience as Christians. But they felt like they couldn't say no or they were going to lose their job. Now, this is perfectly legal to do in Poland. They don't have to work for that company. They could go find another job, except there aren't jobs as good as those in Poland. So this is how woke capitalism moves in and carries with it a whole way of seeing culture, a sort of cultural imperialism, if you will, that is absolutely dead set against Christianity. In fact, I have a friend in New York, a traditional Catholic who works for a major bank. He went out and got a real estate license because he could see how woke his company was becoming and said, I feel like the day is going to come when they ask me, why aren't you joining in gay pride celebrations? Your silence is convicting you. And that's going to be the day when he has to resign and go do something else.
You spoke earlier about China's social score that they assign to individuals. How does woke capitalism use surveillance and the data that's constantly being gathered on each of us to enforce the orthodoxy of progressivism?
Well, what they'll be able to do is build a profile for us, a digital profile of the kind of people we are based on the things we buy, the places we go, GPS coordinates, things like that. And they'll be able to pick out who the problematic people are. And they will be able to do things like it's already happening now. Some banks are refusing to do business with, for example, gun manufacturers. Just won't do business with you. You can't have a bank account there. A friend of mine in Georgia 2 weeks ago went to a sporting goods store and they happened to mention to him that their bank had broken business with them because they sell guns. Well, so far now you can go to another bank, but what happens if the entire banking industry, using the data it collects legally, digitally, and buys on the open market, what happens when they decide that they don't want to do business with you, that it will be bad business for them to be associated with a bigot like you? That is something that is happening more and more, and we're going to see it more and more. I talked to a man for this book. He's a physician working here in America, immigrated from the Soviet Union, converted to Christianity here in America. He's high up in a hospital. He said that he will not post anything on his social media because he knows the human resources department at the hospital is monitoring him and all the other senior employees to see if they're posting anything that could be construed as bigoted. The same doctor said at his hospital that neither he nor any of the other physicians are allowed to say no when patients come demanding cross-sex hormones, even for children. If they want it, the doctors have to give it to them, even if the doctors say this is not right for them. And if they don't do it, the doctors will be fired. And again, the same physician was saying, and I only put the most happy clappy things on social media because I know they're gathering that data to keep a profile on me to see if any of us are problematic. Imagine this sort of thing happening millions and millions of times, and you understand the kind of trouble that we're in. I was sitting in an apartment in Prague talking to Kamila Bendova. She is the wife of one of the top Czech dissidents. He was one of the few Christians in the top circles of power in the dissident community in Czechoslovakia. And she told me, she goes, I don't understand why you Americans are so naive. You know, you let these companies collect all this data from you by using your Alexa smart speakers and your smartphones, things like that. You all think that it's never going to be used against you because you don't do anything wrong. But if you've had to live under what we've lived under, you know that information will always be used against you one way or the other. And she pointed, Todd, to the wall, and on the wall of her apartment, there were these scars in the paint where she and her husband, after communism fell, had to pull the wires out of the wall that the government had put in there to spy on their family. And she said that you can't be so sanguine about giving over this information, even to companies, because it will be used against you one day, and you won't even see it coming.
Explain what Alexander Solzhenitsyn meant by "live not by lies," that famous essay of his.
Yeah, that's the essay he published just before the Soviets kicked him out of the country in 1974. Solzhenitsyn's point was this, that people who dissented against a totalitarian regime had no power to change the regime at all, but one thing they could do is refuse to give assent to it in any way. He said that the whole regime depends on everybody agreeing that the lies it tells are true. Now, by the way, Václav Havel in the Czech Republic, or the future Czech Republic, he said the same thing in his own way, that communism depended on everybody agreeing to the lie. If you were willing to not participate in lies and the ceremonies of lies, like meetings where nobody could speak the truth, then that was, in your way, a protest against the lie. And if you were willing to suffer, Solzhenitsyn said, to suffer for the truth and to not care what they did to you, just as long as you could stand up for the truth, then you would gain a victory, maybe a small victory, a victory that would come at a heavy price for you. But in the end, your willingness to suffer for your faith and for the truth would send a signal that it is possible to live in the truth. You don't have to go along with this, with the lie, just to maintain all your comforts. And this is what Solzhenitsyn said we all had to do. You know, he said, if you are not willing to do this, if you're willing to live by lies just to preserve your comfort, then you deserve what you get. We're nothing more than a herd of sheep.
You say that the core of what religion brings to anti-totalitarianism is a reason to die. What do you mean by that?
See, this is the core of it right there. We have to be aware that Christianity is a religion of martyrs. The idea of the prosperity gospel, that if we're only faithful, God is going to prosper us, we're going to be rich. Hey, you know what? Maybe that will happen. Maybe God will bless us that way. But it is possible that God will bless us with a cross. You know, and if we look back to the early church, it was a church of martyrs. The churches in the Soviet bloc, they were churches of martyrs. Everywhere I went talking to people, whether it was a Baptist in Russia, Eastern Orthodox in Russia, Catholics in other countries in Eastern Europe, every one of them said that if people in the West are not willing to die for their faith, then they're not going to withstand what's coming. I remember that this was the conversation that got to me the most. I was in a hotel lobby in Moscow last fall talking to Alexander Ogorodnikov. He converted to Christianity in his early 20s, and this was in the 1970s. And he came from a really prominent communist family. So when he converted to Christianity, the state really wanted to make an example of him. They threw him into the gulag. They tortured him. Even to this day, his face is partly paralyzed from the beatings he took. But he gave that powerful testimony, echoing everybody I had talked to before him, saying that we prove our willingness to live for Christ by being willing to suffer for him, even die. And it's hard. It's a hard teaching, and it's something that we almost never hear in our churches, and we don't want to hear it in American society. But brother, we have got to listen to these people, to listen to their witness and their testimony, and take them seriously. Because if we're not willing to suffer the loss of status or even the loss of our life for the sake of the gospel, then we're going to lose what God has given us.
In that vein, Rod, is the church ready for soft totalitarianism?
No, not at all. Not now. You know, a friend of mine a couple of years ago was saying, she's an evangelical and does a lot of work with the persecuted church in the Arab world and in Africa. And she told me that she got a call from one of the people, I think it's in Egypt that she works with. And the Egyptian said, "Sister, I'm praying for you. I'm praying for you all in the American church." And my friend said, "What are you talking about? We're free here." And the Egyptian said, "Yeah, but your freedom, you don't know what it means to suffer for your faith. And you all are coming in for a big trial and you don't even see it coming. And you're not ready for it. We've been living under persecution here for a long time. We know what it costs to be a Christian. We know the cost of discipleship. You Americans don't." I think that's true, Todd. I think that you look everywhere and we're so complacent in this country. We think that it's only a matter of voting politically and getting the right judges in the courts and everything's going to be okay. We think the churches are going to be here forever. It's just not true. This is one of the lessons Solzhenitsyn said and all the other dissidents said too, that if you think it can't happen in your country, You're wrong about that. Everything can fall apart in just a matter of a few years. We in the churches, whether we're Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox, we have got to recognize this truth and get ourselves ready for it. These dissidents from the former Soviet bloc, they know what this is like, and they have so many lessons to tell us. When I was over there, Todd, some of these people said, you know, we're so grateful to you Americans. You stood by us during the Cold War. You gave us hope. You gave us support. We're grateful for that. And I said to them, I'm grateful for you because we need your witness now to help us through this very different kind of totalitarianism that is coming upon us.
So with only a minute here, Rod, what would you say to someone who says, look, this is America? Totalitarianism can never happen here.
I'd say you're being a fool. Solzhenitsyn said in one of his books in the Gulag Archipelago, he said, just imagine the intellectuals of the 1890s in Russia, Chekhov and these others, talking about the illiberalism of the Tsar. What would they have said if you'd come to them and told them within 30 years, you will have medieval tortures brought to this country, you will have killing fields, you'll have gulags? That could happen here in Russia, which had been Christian for 1,000 years. It can come here to America, too. We can't doubt it. We're blessed with freedom right now, but we've got to use that freedom to protect our right to be Christians and to prepare ourselves for the day when most people in this country turn on us, because it can happen here. Don't doubt it.
Rod Dreher is senior editor at the American Conservative, and he's author of the new book, Live Not by Lies, A Manual for Christian Dissidents. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Rod, thank you very much.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the work you do.
Last night's presidential debate was very interesting, to say the least. It was contentious. It was sometimes difficult to follow. We're going to be talking about that first presidential debate in retrospect with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway of Fox News next.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
At Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Rockland, California, we keep the focus on Christ every Sunday with ancient liturgy, preaching from the lectionary, and celebration of the sacrament of the altar. Come be a part of the evangelical and Catholic faith as handed down to us in the Lutheran confessions. We celebrate the divine service every Sunday at 8 o'clock and 10:30, with Sunday school for all ages at 9:15. To learn more, visit holycrossrockland.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook. Facebook.com/Luther Academy.